This is XTP Media.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Ready for takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 77 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by author and journalist Santiago Rivas, a well-known expert on military aviation in South America. This episode features a discussion on the Argentine preparation, operations, and results for the Falklands conflict. We focus entirely on air operations as part of the 35th anniversary of this conflict. As our guest, Santiago kindly agreed to help us better understand the Argentine angle to the air war, and on that basis, whether you might agree or feel uncomfortable, we allowed the discussion to proceed without my own built-in bias or lack of understanding influence the programme. If at any time I've done this, then I apologise. This episode is dedicated to all of those from all sides of the conflict who didn't return home. This is the Argentine viewpoint of the air war. Santiago, welcome to Extended.
Thank you very much.
Tell me a little bit about your aviation background.
Yes, I started 20 years ago. I always loved aviation since I was a kid. But 20 years ago, when I was 20 years old, I started as a photographer and journalist on aviation.
Yeah,
working firstly for Argentinian magazines, but immediately I started working also for European media on all military aviation mainly, but also on commercial aviation.
Right.
Doing articles, photography. In 2007, I published my first book, which was also about the Falklands War.
Okay.
But it was a small book published in Brazil.
Okay. Okay. Now, you mentioned books there. Of course, it goes without saying that most of what we will talk about is in your book, The Wings of the Malvinas. I'm very lucky enough to have read that book, and we can talk about that a little later where people can get it. It's a very comprehensive book about the conflict. With an awful lot of research. It's very neutral. So anyone who's listening to this who thinks it's written from any angle, it's not written from any angle. Tell me about the research and how you went about creating the book, because it's very, very detailed.
Thank you. Yes, I started. I was a kid when the conflict occurred. But I always thought about the conflict, and when I started on journalism, I started to research about the war, meeting a lot of veterans. On those times, most of the veterans were still on activity on the Air Force, the Navy, and the Army, so it was common to find them on the bases. So I started making interviews to many of them, and since then, in 1997, I started doing a research about the war with my intention was on the future to make a big book. So then when I made that small book, I started to work on a bigger one, and then started to look also for editors and making all the research, which was in some parts was not very difficult to get some veterans. But also some archives are not easy to get access, and some information was very difficult to find. So it was a big work took me a lot of time. Mostly was about 5 years of working a lot of times every day to prepare the book. But in the end, I think I could get a lot of information that was not published before, and for me it was amazing to do it.
Yeah, and maybe we can talk about some of the things that certainly I picked up in the book that I'd never heard of before. But let's start talking about the air war 35 years ago now. How did the Argentine Air Force and the Argentine Navy prepare? What was the preparation that was in place before the war for the invasion?
Yes, in fact, this is one of the main failures of the war on the Argentinian side, is that there was no big preparation for the war. The plan for the landing on the islands was made by the Navy mostly, without a big participation of the Air Force. Most of the Air Force officers knew about the landings on the same day. Many of the pilots I interviewed told me that they knew about the landing hearing the radio when they were going to their base on that day. So there was no preparation. In fact, for example, due to the doctrine of the Navy and Air Force, the Air Force couldn't have any training for operations over the sea because of the fight between the Navy and the Air Force for many years. The Navy declared that all the operations over the sea will be made by the Naval Aviation, and the Air Force will focus only on operations over land. So when this war started, the Navy declared that they don't have enough resources for the war, especially for the air war over the sea, and they asked the Air Force to make their part in the war. So they started preparing for the conflict after the landings, not
wow.
before.
Okay. And just so I can understand this a little bit better, Santiago, the structure of the Argentine Air Force, it was historically based upon British and European structures, wasn't it?
Yes. In 1949, the Air Force was completely modified. The Air Force was separated from the Army in 1945. And in 1949, the structure was completely changed from regiments, which were inherited from the Army, to air brigades. Then in 1951 was another restructuration to air, and in the end the organization was mostly based on the wings of the Royal Air Force, with an air brigade, like a wing, with air groups and squadrons, because on that time the Air Force was very big. Most of the equipment was also purchased in the UK, like the Lincolns, Lancasters, Gloucester Meteors. And there was a lot of training from Royal Air Force instructors that was contracted with the planes. So that all the organization was based on the World War II Royal Air Force organization. This is in part is still until today. Now the problem is that the Air Force is much smaller, but they still keep the organization with brigades, groups, and squadrons.
Yeah, okay. And in the preparations and the lead-up to the early days of the conflict, well, one of the challenges that started to become a very apparent, and I suppose it reflects what you've said about the Navy and the Air Force there, is the islands themselves are close to the mainland, but they're not that close, and one of the biggest challenges for the aircraft was, of course, refueling and their ability to be active over the islands. And one of the things I read in preparing for the conflict, it became very apparent very early that there was a complete lack of long-range aircraft and refueling capabilities, and in fact, the whole air war, from an Argentine perspective, from refueling, was supported by two KC-130 tankers.
Yes, Yeah, Argentinian Air Force get their first when the A4Bs and C were purchased. The A4B, in fact, they received some body packs for air refueling. Yeah. Where they start the first training in history for the Argentinian Air Force, but the body pack wasn't enough for this kind of missions. So in 1978, the two KC-130s were bought, and they were the only assets for air refueling during the war. And they are the only assets still today.
Right, okay. And literally those two airframes are still operating. Okay. And there was consideration as well to converting some of the 707s, I think the Aerolíneas Argentinas 707s, to tankers as well, but there just wasn't enough time, was there?
Yes. During the war, there were many plans to get more tankers like the 707s, but as you say, there was no time. And it was very complicated also to buy the equipment, because the British were putting a lot of pressure against any Argentinian purchase everywhere. So it was almost impossible to get the equipment also.
Yeah. But it was clear to me that, and we should recognise this, that Argentina had also created its own aircraft development and production facilities as well. And of course, the most recognisable aircraft that was used in the conflict was the Picara, of course. But Argentina did create its own manufacturing and aerospace industry, didn't it?
Yes. Yes, we have a factory since 90 years old, which is in Córdoba, the factory that made the Picara and many other aircraft in the past. But on the times of the war, the only plane that was used by this factory was the Picara. But the factory started building planes in 1927. Initially, there were Avro 504 under license, so it was the British plane. But it made a lot of local designs over history. The most important projects were in the 40s and 50s when they made a jet aircraft, the first Latin American jet aircraft with the Pulque and Pulque 2.
Yeah. But in terms of the aircraft that the Air Force and the Navy had on hand, I think it's clear to me that it was a bigger fleet of aircraft than I ever was aware of. And of course, there were aircraft like the Neptune, there were S2 Trackers, and aircraft like that that were in the Argentine inventory, but not necessarily that active in terms of the early stages of the air conflict.
Yes, in the beginning, yes, there were some aircraft like the Neptunes. They were retired in the middle of the conflict.
Right.
I don't know exactly what you're meaning with the question.
What I was saying was, I think from my reading and research, the Argentine Air Force had a much larger complement of aircraft than I think most English people, for certain, most British people ever imagined. The Argentine Air Force was not a small air force, was it? It was quite a powerful air force in South America.
Yes, but that time was one of the most powerful. I think only the Brazilian was a bigger, the Argentinian, the Cuban was also big. So it was, through the years until after the war, it was one of the biggest air forces in Latin America. Always the Argentinian and Brazilian ones were the biggest, so it was a big air power about those times.
Yeah. And one of the other things that struck me in terms of the preparation for the conflict, as well as some of the operation, was the use of civilian aircraft as well. There were a significant number of, well, I suppose what we would class civilian aircraft, involved in the conflict. You know, things like the Learjets and the Hawker Sydney 125s and Citations used for reconnaissance missions, as radio relay aircraft, but also they were used as diversionary aircraft as well, on missions to divert the British attention.
Yes. Yes, the idea of the Phoenix Squadron, which was the name of this unit, is from the was born in 1978 with the conflict with Chile to create a special unit with civil aircraft. It was recreated for the war in 1982, and they had a lot of missions. One, as you say, is diversionary, to try to show on the radars as fighter aircraft. So there were also pictures of planes simulating refuelings with the KC-130 to simulate being A-4s. Also, they were used for relay for communications between the islands and the continent for the attacks units, attack aircraft. In some cases, not with jets, but with prop aircraft, they used them to escort the pucaras that were crossing to the islands, because the navigation equipment of the pucaras was very basic. They also performed liaison, reconnaissance, and many other missions.
Yeah.
Now, most of the missions were over the mainland, which are not very well known. Most are transport and liaison, but there are a lot over the islands or over the ocean.
Yeah, and certainly in the early days of the conflict and before British fleet arrived in the region, I saw that they were used an awful lot more. One other question, Santiago, just before we start to talk about the invasion itself, was how well prepared were the Argentine forces in terms of assessing the British threat and I suppose the resolve of the British to take the islands?
Yes, this is another of the big failures of the war, I think, because the plan was made by the Navy. They thought that the British were not going to deploy the troops to the island. They simply said that it's very far for them, they're not going to come, so we only have to prepare an occupation and then negotiate a final solution for the islands. That's why when they landed on the islands, immediately they left. On the first day, they only left a small garrison on the island, with three Pucaras, some other aircraft. The idea was to left some companies of infantry, not even a regiment, and even the units that landed on the islands were returned to the continent 2-3 days after the landings. When the Argentinian government knew that the British were coming, then they started to plan how to defend the islands for the invasion. And the intelligence about the British forces was not too much. They only knew what it was known by everybody about the how many ships they have and the aircraft, but not too much.
Okay. And as the fleet left Ascension Island and approached the South Atlantic region, there were examples that you investigated and talk about in the book of the 707 in particular being used for reconnaissance. I thought that was quite fascinating. The dancing that the British and the Argentine air forces did in the northern part of the South Atlantic.
Yes, those were the first missions because the Argentinian forces knew about the only thing they knew about the British forces was when they left the UK, and nothing more. They said that because the Russians were doing intelligence gathering, but it's not public and it's still a secret if they gave information to Argentina or not. And then Argentina, the first thing they did is to send some cargo ships of ELMA, which was the state-owned company, to sail near Ascension Island to try to see how many ships and the kind of ships. Even one of the ships was sought by British ships, and they asked him to leave. So they get some information about the ships that were being gathering in Ascension, but nothing after that. So that's when the idea was to send the 707s to make the reconnaissance. And as originally the British government said, they were only attack any aircraft or ship or troop inside the exclusion zone. They knew that they were not going to fire against the 707s. Anyway, the crews, when I interviewed them, so they were not completely sure if they are not going to fire against them.
Yeah, yeah. And just jumping further along, Santiago, there was you talk also, whilst we're on the 707, about HMS Cardiff, when it shot a sea dart at the 707 and they managed to avoid it.
Yes, in fact, there were four missiles, two by Cardiff and two by Bristol. The problem was that they were fired almost at the limit of the range of the missiles.
Yeah.
So I talked with one of the radar operators of Cardiff, and he told me the problem that initially the 707 made a first approach, and they get well into the range of the sea dart.
Yeah.
But on that time, the Bristol was the in command of the group of ships, and the guys on Bristol said that they have to hang on and wait, because they were not completely sure if the plane was an Argentinian Air Force plane. So they had to wait. Then the Boeing left the area, and then appeared again, and they fired the missiles immediately. So they were almost out of range. And the crew of the Boeing 707, they saw the missiles, so they started to dive. The main problem is that because the missiles were fired at the end of the range, at the limit, they don't have a lot of maneuverability. So it was easy for the 707 to avoid them.
I'm sure they didn't see it that way, but I understand what you're saying. I do apologize for jumping around there. Let's go back then to the actual invasion itself. What aircraft were used in the invasion in terms of taking the islands originally?
Yes, on the landings there were no aircraft initially. Only immediately after the airport was taken, landed some Hercules with troops. But they don't take part on the landing itself. They just send some troops to reinforce the garrison, and then some Fokker 28s also with more personnel, but all the administrative personnel to run the government of the islands. And on that day, only three Pucaras landed, but on the afternoon, just to provide some protection on the islands. And from the aircraft carrier landed, I think it was two trackers, I don't remember exactly now, but only to make some presence of the Navy. They stayed for a couple of days, and then they returned to the carrier.
Right, okay.
So, and that was all the participation of the aviation, plus some helicopters, but also for medical evacuation of the two guys wounded on the islands, on the landings. One of them died after that. And some reconnaissance, and also some helicopters, some Sea King helicopters went to all the other small towns on the islands to send some small groups of troops. But they saw no action in combat.
From across the globe, from the center of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science, and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures, and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics, and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit aerosociety.com.
So as the British fleet steamed southwards and the recognised, I suppose the conflict was inevitable, how did the Air Force and the Navy start to prepare to defend the islands from the air?
Yes, first the naval aviation has to work on the superintendents. The ships were, the aircraft were very new. They had arrived in December 1981.
Yeah.
And they didn't make the integration of the aircraft with the Exocet missiles. So the main worry of the Navy was to make that integration. The command of the Navy put them a limit of 1 month to do it. But they did it on 2 weeks. Originally, Aerospatiale from France, the French government asked all the technicians to go back to France, but the truth is that some of them remained in Argentina, and they helped the Argentinian technicians to work on the missiles. So that was the main work of the Navy.
And there were only...
Sorry
to interrupt you, Santiago. There were only a limited number of Exocet missiles, wasn't there?
Yeah, there were only 5 missiles delivered by that time.
Yeah.
The Argentinian Navy tried to get more,
yeah,
mainly through Peru, but it was impossible to get them.
Right, okay. And in terms of any other training that the pilots and the air crews were put through, how did the rest of the preparations unfold? We obviously are aware of the use of the A4s in particular in the conflict. How then were they being readied for conflict?
Yes, the first thing was to know, to learn for the Air Force crews about the war over the sea against ships. So they started first working with some collaboration with the Navy to define the altitude and how to attack a ship. Fortunately for the Argentinian forces, they had 2 Type 42 destroyers, like the Sheffield. So, and with all the same systems, so they made a lot of training with those ships to know at which altitude they couldn't detect them, the aircraft, the radars, and how the Sea Dart missiles worked. That was one part of the training did by all the Argentinian Air Force aircraft, from A4s, Mirages, Daggers, and Canberras. And also they perform, especially the A4Bs, they perform attack sorties against a wreck of a very old ship close to Rio Gallegos, where they were based. There's an old ship on the beach, and they perform a lot of attack sorties against the ship to train also all the procedures to attack a ship and how to see it from very far away and the altitude, everything.
Yeah. And Santiago, one of the things that's apparent and some of our previous guests have talked about is the fact that as the A4s in particular came in to attack the ships, because they flew so low and dropped their bombs at such a low height, the bombs didn't have time to fuse and activate. How quickly was this known? Was this known before the event, or was this something that the pilots learned during the conflict?
Yes, as the bombs were all prepared for attack against ground targets, on not against ships. So all the fuses were prepared for that kind of targets. And that was the main problem. They didn't knew how to prepare them to attack ships on the Air Force. So, and they learned about that after, I think it was the BBC or another British media, they published that the bombs were not exploding. That was the first information the Argentinian Air Force had about the bombs. So immediately after that, I think that was on the 21st or 22nd of May,
yep,
during San Carlos.
Yeah.
And after that, they start working on the fuses. They changed all the fuses. And also they stopped using, they kept using, but not too much, the Mark 17 bombs. And they started using more the Expal bombs, which were Spanish built. with different fuses. And the first time they used that was on the attack on Coventry. And you see, they dropped three bombs and at least two of them exploded.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so that lesson was learned. Going back then to the end of April and the beginning of May of that year, and the British fleet steaming closer to the islands, of course everyone was aware of the Harrier. How were the Argentine pilots preparing for combat with the Sea Harrier?
In fact, they didn't know a lot about the performance of the Harrier, so it was very difficult for them. They just had to do it on theory, no practice against a plane with similar performance. So it was very difficult for them. They just knew about the Harrier when they had the first air-to-air combats on 1st of May. So it was not easy for them. Just imagine what could be a combat with the Sea Harrier.
Yeah, and how well from those pilots' viewpoints did those early engagements go? I mean, they're very very detailed in the book, but can you give us a flavour for what it was like for those Argentine pilots in those very early skirmishes?
Yes, some of them, there are different views about that. For example, because in fact there were only four air-to-air combats between fighters and fighters, with the Argentinian planes on fighter configuration. One of them was when Ardiles was shot down, but he was alone against two Sea Harriers, so it was impossible for them or him. When he was trying to engage one of the Sea Harriers, the other one shot him down with a Sidewinder. The other one was the only combat with Mirage 3s and Sea Harriers when Perona was shot down. And in his case, one of the fuel tanks didn't release when he ejected him. So the plane was not stabilized. It was impossible to maneuver, and he was shot down. And there were two other combats on that day. One was by Moreno and Volponi against two Sea Harriers, and one was Mir Gonzalez, and I don't remember the pilot. And on those cases, it was different because there were no superiority between, in any case, known the Sea Harriers or the Daggers, neither of them can shut down any other plane.
Yeah, they couldn't gain an advantage.
Yes, and when you talk with them, I was with Moreno a couple of days ago and talking about this. And he says, for him, it was completely different because he saw that there was no advantage. They just maneuver for about 3-4 minutes, and then they were all short on fuel, and the Sea Harriers disengage, and then they disengage at the same time. So nothing happened in the end. And for him, as for example, say that he thinks that it could be possible for an Argentinian plane to shut down a Sea Harrier.
Right.
But after that day, they received the order that they were not going to engage the Sea Harriers anymore. They had to try to avoid them. And all the missions after that were of planes were only attack sorties, air combat.
Right.
Not combat air patrols.
Right, okay.
There's also discussion because the Mirage 3s, they made very few missions after that, and they were only staying at 30,000 feet on combat air patrol, but the Sea Harriers, they had no interest on going to that height because all the action was at low level.
Yeah,
so
okay.
It had no sense to...
Yeah, of course, because the Sea Harriers were going after the ground attack and the aircraft attacking the ships, weren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, fascinating.
So having the Mirages at that height had no sense.
Yeah.
So there's still a discussion inside the Air Force between the pilots saying that why they send the Mirages at that height and not lower where they can engage the Sea Harriers.
Yeah. And we heard an awful lot about the Israeli designed and the daggers as well. How influential were they in the conflict?
Yeah, the daggers, in fact, were used by the Israelis. The official version is that they were built in Israel, but in fact, they were built in France and assembled in Israel.
Right, okay.
So, in fact, it's a Miraz 5. The problem is that there was an embargo on Israel, so the French cannot sell the planes. But if you see the planes, you will see that all the plates with the serial numbers are French.
Right, okay.
And you see that they are all built in France. Only yeah. assembled in Israel. But the main thing with the daggers, when the Argentina purchased the daggers, but was all the training by Israeli instructors. The main of them was Shlomo Eris, who was an Israeli pilot who fought on the Six-Day War and Yom Kippur. And he gave a lot of training to the Argentinians, especially with all his experience.
Very highly skilled.
Yes. So that was very important for the Dagger pilots on air-to-air combat mainly.
Yeah.
And you see that the two combats of Dagger pilots against the Harriers, there were no superiority by the British or the Argentinians.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. That's very interesting. Let's go back then to talk about the shift from the air-to-air war to the air-to-ground and air-to-sea attacks. When it was apparent that the British were going to retake the islands, and obviously the fleet moved in closer, tell us about the use of air power to attack, particularly in the first instance, the ships.
Yes, originally there was... There was no big plan on how to win the war by Argentinian forces. So it was more like a reaction to every British action.
Yeah.
So you see on the 1st of May, when the British force, the first British ships approached Stanley to bomb the Argentinian positions, there was the first strike against the ship. But it was more a reaction after the ships were sought by the ground forces. They asked for the air strike. On that day, there were also some other missions sent from the continent to attack British ships. But there was not very clear on which ships were the targets. Those were the missions, for example, of the Canberras on that day, where one of the planes was shot down.
Yeah.
They were sent to attack British ships close to the islands, close to Stanley, but not with very clear information. As I said, it was more a reaction, and all the plan was more to wait what the British are going to do and then try to attack them and strike back to their actions.
Okay. Okay, and you mentioned the Canberra there, and initially the Canberras were used both in the bombing and reconnaissance mode. They were later moved to use as night bombers as well, weren't they, to avoid the Sea Harriers?
Yes, after the one of them was shot down by the Sea Harriers on the 1st of May, the Air Force decided the Canberra was very vulnerable against the Sea Harriers. They had nothing against them.
Yeah.
So that's why they decided to operate at night and only against ground targets.
Yeah. And you in the book, you talk about a fascinating read about low-level bombing. I think it's Mount Kent. No lights, no instrument lights, and trying to evade the Sea Harriers. It's a fascinating read of the Canberra up against this Sea Harrier that was buzzing around on combat air patrol, and how they had to sneak through at low level, no lights, no instruments. I think what struck me, Santiago, in this story and in many others, was actually the skill of the Argentine pilots. Because they were very skilled, they were very brave as well, carrying out these carrying out these missions, but the skill of some of the pilots flying at very, very low level, at the absolute maximum range of the aircraft was quite amazing.
Yes, yes. I think it was, they knew that it was the only way to survive, especially on the that case you talk about on the attack on Mont Kent.
Yeah.
They knew that as they had no chance if the Sea Harriers see them with the radar or visually. So they know that diving and trying to escape without hitting the mountains was the only way to survive. So if they stayed at a high level, they were very easy for the Sea Harriers, especially because the British troops on San Carlos and around the islands, they got the Canberras and radars, and they were guiding the Sea Harriers.
Yeah. Yeah, and let's talk then about the A4s and the Skyhawks. Tell us about the different types of A4 that we used, because there were several different models that we used, and what were their roles during the conflict?
Yes, the A4, the Air Force had two different models, the A4B and C, and the Navy had the A4B. They call it Q.
Yeah.
Because the Q and the Bs on the Air Force, which the Americans called them P, they were basically very similar. And therefore, they were both A4Bs with some modifications asked for by Argentina, like air brakes and different equipment from more modern Skyhawks.
Yeah.
And but they were basically A4Bs. Argentina bought 50 A4Bs, the Argentine Air Force, in 1966. And then in the 70s, they bought 25 A4Cs. The A4C came without any modification, only some minor equipment. And in the meantime, in 1971, the Navy bought the A4Qs, which is interesting to us regarding the A4Qs is that initially, when Argentina asked the Americans to buy the A4s, the Americans denied the authorization. So the Argentine Navy tested the Harrier on the Argentinian carrier, because the carrier was leaving Holland. So they tested the Harrier, and there was a negotiation to buy Harriers by Argentinian Navy.
Right. I didn't know that. I didn't know that. Wow. Wow.
Yes, this is not very well known. No. There are some videos and some pictures of the Harrier on the deck of the Argentinian carrier.
Wow.
So in the end, when Argentina was negotiating the Harriers, immediately the Americans offered the Skyhawks very, very cheap. So in the end, they bought the Skyhawks.
Right. And the thing about the Skyhawks, and regardless of the model, they proved in this air war to be extremely capable aircraft, didn't they? Good pilots, well trained, and a lot of the raids were very well executed. And apart from the issues of maintenance and readiness of the aircraft and spares, which, to be fair, I think both sides of the conflict suffered from, the A4 was very well suited to the job that it was used for.
Yes. Yes, it proved a very capable aircraft. One of the main issues was the capability to for air refueling.
Yes.
So they have more range. And I think it was also very important the training of the crews. So because there were, especially the A4Bs of the Air Force and the A4Qs were the more successful aircraft on attack against ships during the war.
Yeah. And
both of the ships were sunk by them. Only the superintendents also were very successful, but because they were the most modern aircraft and with the exocets.
Yeah, let me come back to that, because I want to ask you some questions about that. Just before we go off the A4s, one of the things, and I inferred at the start in terms of the investigation and the research you did, there's some very, very detailed accounts by Argentine pilots of their attack roles in the war. And again, you know, we talk about Bomb Alley and, you know, some of these names and, you know, they've stuck, but they're not really very appropriate. But amazing, the story of the A4B that was so low as it came in, it hit the ship's antenna.
Yes, yeah, on the attack on Antelope, in fact, there were two planes that hit antennas on the attack on Argonaut on the 21st of May. But in this case, it was only a small antenna, so there was only minor damage on the extra fuel tank. But on the 23rd, on the attack against Antelope, the pilot, Luciano Guadagnini, he, at the same moment he dropped the bomb, he was hit by the guns of the frigate, and he crashed on one of the masts of the ship. So he was killed during the attack.
Yeah, it's... I don't quite know how to describe it, but the detail you go to in the book to describe all of these, I've not read in many other accounts. So I would recommend, if nothing else, for people to read those accounts, because they're very honest, they're very raw, and they recognize they recognized for me the skill and the dedication of some of those pilots. Let's talk then about the Super Entendard and the Exocet and the use of the Exocet in the conflict, because I think without doubt it was the biggest fear for most of the British ships, and that was the Super Entendard and being married up to the Exocet. How was it used? What were the missions that it was used on?
Yes, first, as I told you, the main issue for the Navy was to have the missile working on the plane, because they were just starting training. The planes were not training with the missiles, and they did the integration of the missile with the plane. So that was the first work. Then they had to coordinate the attack with the Neptunes, who were doing the surveillance missions.
Yeah.
But the Neptunes were in very, very poor conditions. They were very old. They were retired during the war because the engines especially had a lot of trouble. So they had to change the way they made the missions during the war when the Neptunes stopped operating. So, for example, on the attack on Sheffield, the detection was made by the Neptune, who was doing a surveillance mission to the south of the islands. They were looking for British ships because the intention was to send some Hercules to the islands with supplies. So they were looking for a route for the Hercules.
Yeah.
At the moment, the Neptune crew detected all the ships, not only the Sheffield, or the three Type 42s, the aircraft carriers.
Yeah.
And immediately they asked for the attack by the superintendents. The mission was prepared. For the superintendents, wasn't very difficult for them, because there was they only went for the position where the Neptune gave them, and they detected the ship with the radars and launched the missiles.
Yeah.
The main problem there was because the Neptune crew was having a lot of trouble with the radar. So the radar operator had to work a lot on the radar and fix it in the middle of the flight, because at one moment the radar went completely unserviceable, and they had to fix it, and then the last moment they can make a last transmission, get the new positions of the ships, and transfer gave the position to the superintendent crews to launch the missiles. So that was the first mission. For the superintendent, was just look on the radars if the ships were on the position given by the Neptune, and then fire the missiles. It was completely different with on the attack against Atlantic Conveyor. In fact, all the attacks by the superintendents, the aim was to hit one of the carriers.
Yeah. Santiago, let me ask you there. There's been a lot of claims and a lot of talk that certainly we've heard of the fact that Invincible had been hit or in fact sunk. Can you tell us a bit about that? Because it's not clear where these stories came from or how they developed.
Yes, there are many fantasies from many people who try to make things bigger. Yeah. What we have is the story from both the two A4C pilots that returned from that mission. There were four A4Cs and the superintendents. One of the superintendents with the exocet, they got the targets on the radar and they fired the missile. It was the last missile we had. And then the A4Cs, they followed the missile and tried to hit the ship. Two of the planes were shot down and two returned. The main thing that Argentina has is the story from the two surviving pilots who said that there was a very big ship. One of them says it was an aircraft carrier. The other is not sure. He only says that it was a very big ship with a lot of smoke, but nothing else. So it's impossible from the Argentinian side to prove if the ship was attacked. In my opinion, I don't know. It's very difficult. The only important thing that in any way they get, because of the official, the British version, is that they attacked the Exeter or one of the Type 21 frigates.
Yeah.
In any case, they were very close to the carrier, about 20, 30 miles. So it was a very daring mission, and in any way, they get very close to the carriers, which proved that they can do it, this kind of attack. They cannot do it again because there were no more missiles, but in fact, they get the position of the ship and they went very close to the carrier anyway.
Listen, I haven't got long. It's about The Aviation Historian, the magazine the mainstream monthlies don't want you to know about. It's a new compact format quarterly journal, exploring the less well-known paths of flying history. It's created by experienced, award-winning former Aeroplane magazine editors Mick Oakey and Nick Stroud. It's not in the shops, but you can get it via the website, theaviationhistorian.com.
Oi, we know you're in there!
They're coming for me. I've got to go. Remember, The Aviation Historian.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
After the last Exocet was used, and apologies for interrupting you earlier, by the way, Sandy. When the last Exocet was used, what was the role of the superintendents after that? Were they used in any capacity?
No. As this is one of the critics made by the Air Force. Because the Navy was trying to get more missiles, so they decided to keep them, to send them back to their base in Bahía Blanca, to Comandante Espora Air Base, and wait for more missiles. So there's a lot of criticism from the Air Force saying that why they didn't use them with bombs anyway, because there were five planes that could be used against ships anyway.
Yeah, and using conventional weaponry.
Yes, with bombs. Yeah. They had a lot of bombs. Even they had air-to-air missiles, so they could be used for air defense too.
Yeah, and why were they not used then? Because although we've talked about the success of the A4, I would imagine the superintendent would have been very good in that mission.
Yeah, the idea was to keep them and wait if they can get more exocets. The Navy was working very hard to get more missiles.
Right.
Some even were stopped inside a cargo ship that in France, that the idea was to send them to Peru and then to Argentina. But the British government knew about that operation, because officially it was the Peruvian government who was asking for the missiles. And the British government knew about all the story, and they let know the French government, and the French government stopped that cargo ship from leaving the harbor with the missiles. So the Argentine Navy was working a lot to get the missiles, and they were convinced that they were going to get more missiles before the end of the war. That's why they decided to keep the aircraft and save them in case we get more missiles.
But it was becoming apparent that the losses were increasing, and an aircraft like the Pucará, and I would like to come back and talk about the role of the Pucará, but they were being taken out in high numbers. The A4s were slowly getting depleted, getting shot down, but also there was the challenge of spares and operations and keeping the aircraft in the air as well. And on missions, what was the morale like of the pilots and the crews trying to keep these aircraft going when it was becoming apparent that the opportunity was slipping away to defend the islands?
Yes, and there are two different areas, because the Pucarás on the islands, the main problem was the weather. The planes were not only damaged and destroyed in form by bombings or on the SAS attack on Pebble Island, but also the main problem was to keep the aircraft operational on the islands with the humidity, which damaged all the electrical systems. There were not too many spares on the islands and tools also to work on the aircraft. So that's why many planes remain out of service by minor damage or minor things. They couldn't operate them anymore. And this is the case of the planes on the islands. And on the case of the planes on the mainland, like the Air Force and Daggers and Mirages, yeah. There is different. In the case of the Air Force, the main problem was they lost a lot of pilots. Most of the pilots of the Air Force were shut down, couldn't eject.
Yeah.
So the two A4 units of the Air Force they lost a lot of pilots, and they don't have too many pilots in the end of the war. And also there were many problems to keep the aircraft operational, especially when the planes returned with damage. They had to work very fast on them. And also the units lost a lot of aircraft. For example, the A4Bs, 10 of them were shut down, and 9 A4Cs. So the unit of the A4Cs lost more than about one half or more of their aircraft,
yeah.
And more about one half of the pilots. And the same with the A4Bs. They lost about one third of the aircraft and about also one third of the pilots.
Right. And how did this affect morale in the air crews and the crews?
Yes, that affected a lot, especially in those units, because they were seeing every day they were going to combat. They saw they were losing a lot of crews, of pilots. It's not the same, for example, with the Daggers, as most of them ejected safely. And some of them also were recovered by Argentinian forces and returned to the mainland before the end of the war.
Yeah.
So they lost very few pilots. I think it was 4 or 5 pilots of the Daggers. And the Mirage 3 is only one pilot. Yes, also the Canberras, they lost one crew on the 1st of May, and the other crew were only one of the crew members of the second plane shot down was killed. But that plane was lost at the last moments of the war. So during the war, they had lost only one crew until the end.
Yeah. And Santiago, what was the view of the potential attack by the British forces on the mainland? What aircraft were used, and what was the preparations for an attack on potentially one or two of those bases?
Yes, what I know is that they planned to attack mainly Rio Grande, which was the base of the Subfertendarts, also the Skyhawks of the Navy, and the one of the Dagger squadrons.
Yeah.
The aim was to do an attack to destroy the Subfertendarts and maybe kill the pilots, with landing with the Hercules on the islands, on the base,
Yeah.
Deploy a group of the SAS, try to destroy the planes and kill the pilots, and then try to escape. A couple of years ago, I talked a lot with Ewan Southby Taylor, who wrote a book about that mission,
yeah,
called Exocets. And discussing with him, he put it on his book that he sees it was impossible, like a suicide mission, because there were anti-aircraft artillery all around the runway. So after the Hercules landed, it would be a very easy target to destroy. The fact that the SAS troops, they didn't know where the superintendents were hidden, because they changed it from the position yeah. every day, and where the crews were sleeping. Most of the crews usually lived on civilian houses on the city, and right, they were changing okay. all the time.
Yeah.
So the only possibility to find them was to go to the town and try to visit all the houses and try to find the crews. So it was impossible to, and that's why I think that's why one of the reasons they canceled the mission in the end.
Right. Okay. And during the conflict, as particularly as the ships went into the Sound, particularly the A4s were attacking them. How did the Argentine air tactics evolve? How did they change? How did they learn to be better? What was going on there? How were they using that experience to improve their performance?
Yes, in fact, there were not too many changes during the operations. They knew, as for example, this that flying, as we talked earlier, that flying very low, the bombs were not getting armed and they were not exploded. But they knew also that flying higher was more dangerous for them. So yeah. they kept flying low. And but there were not many changes on the tactics, especially on the Air Force.
Right.
They were just doing the same, flying, trying to see the target, aiming to the target, flying as low as possible, and try to drop the bombs on the target. Yeah. The only change was on the fuses to try to get the bombs exploding.
Right. Okay. And as the conflict progressed, the experience of how the Sea Harriers, in particular, were being used, and from the British perspective, they were starting to learn. Certainly direction of attacks and some of the Argentine tactics. How were the Argentines learning about how the Harriers and how the British Air Forces were being used? How were they learning that, and what were they doing to change the way they were attacking?
Yeah, the main thing was to try to change all the time the routes to approach the islands. Initially, they tried the shortest one, especially at San Carlos, trying to fly directly over West Falkland and directly into San Carlos. And then they started changing it. First, they tried to the north, and that's why the Royal Navy sent the Coventry and Broadsword to the north to yep. shut down the planes there. And then they started also some route from the south of the islands, approaching to the south and then flying north. As for example, they did that on 24th of May. They approached from the south to San Carlos,
yep.
and then they flied over Goose Green and then directly to the north to San Carlos, approaching very low over the mountains.
Yep.
This is, you can see that there's a very famous video of the Skyhawks attacking San Carlos on that day.
Yeah.
And that mission, they approached from the south. The same day, they did it on the 8th of June on Fitzroy. They approached the island from the south, crossed East Falkland from the south to the north, and then directly to Fitzroy.
And we've said it several times, but these aircraft were then running at the maximum of their range, weren't they? So they didn't have much loiter time. There are a few, I was going to say stories, but accounts in the book of them having to make second attacks. How you've talked to some of those pilots, how did they feel knowing that potentially they would not have enough fuel to return home?
Yes, for them it was very difficult because in some cases they had to ask the Hercules to come to go for them to refuel them because it was impossible to get back. It's not only in the cases where the attacks were longer than expected, but also many cases where the planes returned with damage. For example, there were two cases of Skyhawks that were losing fuel. One of them was very difficult. It was Delepiano, the pilot, who was losing a lot of fuel. It was impossible to him to get back to the mainland. So the Hercules had to approach to the islands to get him, and he had to return to the mainland, engage with the Hercules. And there are also some pictures taken from the base with the plane coming with the Hercules, then leaving the Hercules immediately to land, and the engine stopped after landing because he was losing almost the same quantity of fuel he was getting from the tanker.
Right.
And there's also the one case in the 8th of June, the last escadrille that was sent against the Sir Galahad and Sir Tristram. In this case, they were engaged by the Sea Harriers of the David Morgan and David Smith. They shot down three of the four aircraft, and the last one, Hector Sanchez, he had to escape. And he had a problem with the fuel system, so he couldn't use one of the tanks. So he escaped from Fitzroy. But he realized he didn't have enough fuel to get back to the mainland. So fortunately, the KC-130 was still on the area, and they went to pick him, and he could engage the tanker when he had I think it was 200 pounds or 500 pounds of fuel, which was for about 1 or 2 minutes of flight only.
Yeah.
And for example, I talk a lot with these pilots, and when he was escaping, he also saw his three wingmen dying in front of him, so yes. He was extremely nervous.
Yes.
And he was convinced that he was going to die on that day.
Yeah.
Even when he saw the Hercules, so it was impossible for him to get him because he had almost no fuel. But in the end, at the last second, he did it.
Yeah. And from everything you know, Santiago, and you, as you've said, you've talked to and done a lot of research both on the British and the Argentine side. Why didn't the British identify the KC-130Hs as the weak spot for the Argentine forces? Because I think the reality is that with hindsight, and I know it's easy to say, but if those two aircraft had been taken out, I think the conflict would have been very different.
Yes, I don't know exactly. They tried in some moments, they planned to send destroyers or ships between the islands and the mainland to try to shut down aircraft there.
Yeah.
But this would make the ships extremely vulnerable to air attacks, because if they send a ship to the west of the islands, all the Argentinian attack aircraft will be in range to destroy those ships. Without a refueling, they can make a lot of attacks against them.
Yeah.
And to try to shut down the tankers with Sea Harriers also meant that they had to send the carriers very close to the islands, within a range of all the Argentinian attack aircraft. So, and the Argentinian radar in the base in Malvinas, in the air base, could detect if there were any Sea Harrier taking off from a carrier very close to the islands. They could detect very easily the position of the carrier. So I think that's why they didn't do it. It was to expose the carriers or any other ship very easily to airstrikes.
And we've talked quite generally, and I do apologise for jumping back and forward. I'm very intrigued, as you probably have picked up by what I read. But there are also some fascinating accounts in the book of just some very unusual things. For example, I wrote a note to ask you about HMS Valiant, the nuclear sub, that was almost hit by bombs that were being dropped from a bomber when it was jettisoning its load. Some of these stories are almost too amazing to believe.
Yes. There's also a story I was told by one of a Sea Harrier pilot, but also by Carlos Moreno, who was a Dagger pilot. On the day they made the engagement on the 1st of May, the British pilot, I think it was Robin Kent, he said that the Daggers fired missiles from the front, from ahead, and the Shafri missile couldn't be fired from ahead. And he said that the missiles almost hit him. So with him and Moreno, we started to investigate what had happened. In fact, what he saw as missiles were the extra fuel tanks when Moreno ejected them.
Ah, right.
So
yeah.
Talking with them, it could have been very interesting if Moreno shot down as he had it with a tank.
Yes.
Because Robin Kent said that the tank was very close to his plane, and that's why he thought there were missiles.
Right, okay. Yeah, so I suppose that
they were crossing to enter combat, and at the last second, Moreno ejected the fuel tanks before they crossed.
Yeah, fascinating. And I did say we'd go back to the Pukara as well, because it is quite an iconic aircraft, and certainly for people in this part of the world, it represents, I think, a lot of the air assets of Argentina. But reading your book, really, the Pukara played quite a small role in comparison to aircraft like the A4, and the Entandards and the Daggers.
Yes. The problem was low serviceability because of those a lot of problems to keep the operational. As I told you, the electrical problems, lack of spares. Also, most of the runways on the islands were of mud. It was almost impossible to operate from there. So there were many accidents while taking off, and a lot of planes went out of service because of that. So, and also operations on the islands during the main combats were very dangerous for them. And for example, on the combats on Goose Green, where it was the main action for the Pukaras, the weather was really bad, so they had to fly very low. And there was not a very good coordination with the ground forces. So when they were approaching the combat area, they didn't have a lot good information about where the British forces were. So the only information they get from the ground controllers was just a position of the Argentinian forces, and said, okay, from to the north are the British, but nothing more. So they had to search for the troops looking when they were approaching. It was very difficult. And also, the pilots told me that all the British forces were moving on very small groups. So to aim the weapons, they didn't find any big target, only groups of 5 or 10 soldiers at least, or smaller. So there were not big targets to fire all the rockets or bombs. Another problem was with bombs firing against troops on this kind of soil. As it's very soft, the soil, all the explosions, the range of the explosions is very small because of the kind of soil. That happened also on the attacks. Yeah, I said by the end of the war, as most of the combats were on the night, and they had no navigation equipment for the night, they couldn't perform any more attack missions. Only a few of three planes only.
Yes. Okay. Well, that's understandable, I suppose. And we also need to consider that we're sitting, as we say, 35 years after the conflict. You know, some of the technology we have now was not available to either side of the conflict. And it was quite interesting to hear stories from some of our previous guests about using things like silver foil to cover radar and to make chaff. Exactly the same thing was being done by the Argentine forces. And, you know, you talk in the book about the chaff dispensers for the Canberras being cut up in a pasta making machine.
Yes, yes. And this machine is still on the museum of Paraná Air Base, where it was the base of the Canberras.
Yeah, yeah. Fascinating stuff.
Also, initially, the families of the pilots, they started cutting them with scissors, all the aluminium plates, and then they get this pasta machine to cut them.
Yeah. It was interesting. Not that there is much to smile about, but I did have a little smile about that when I read that in the book. So Santiago, let's just talk then about the end of the conflict and what happened to the Argentine Air Force and the fleet air arm of the Argentine Navy. What happened at the end of the conflict?
Yes, initially the Air Force, they didn't want to finish the fight. Because they said, and some officers are still saying that the surrender was by the garrison on the islands, but not by the Argentinian government or the Argentinian armed forces. So the Air Force was willing to keep fighting against the British forces, but then the government declared that the war was over and there were not going to be any more operations. So immediately, about 3-4 days after that, they started to return to their bases, and only a small quantity of aircraft remained in the south. So after that, they started to rebuild all the forces, which was not easy for them.
I'll come back to that point in a minute. You've talked to many of the serving officers and men who were air crew, ground crew, and that sort of thing. What do they feel about the conflict now?
Yes, it differs a lot on the force and on the people.
Yeah.
But for many of them, it was the most important thing on their careers and on their life. So many of them they still talk a lot about the war. It's very difficult for many to have only one opinion about how they feel.
I understand.
Many of them, they still think on all the mistakes made. Some of, for example, said we didn't have to go to that war, or at least if they decided to do it, they had to decide to do it with more preparation and not just doing it, planning it a couple of days. And they discuss a lot about if it could be won or not, which is very difficult to determine because it's a lot of what ifs, which is impossible to know what would have happened. In some units, for example, with the A4 units, they felt a lot the loss of so many pilots. So for them, both pilots, they're still feeling that that they lost a lot of comrades. But they focus a lot on the unit and on the force. For example, the Air Force, they always say that they didn't plan the war and they never surrender because the Air Force was mostly on the mainland and they said we never surrender. We were ready to keep fighting. Many blame the Navy because originally the plane was by the Navy and the Navy almost didn't use their surface fleet after the Belgrano was sunk.
Yeah. So, and what about the use of the carrier? What's the view about why it wasn't really used as much as maybe it could have been?
Yes, the main problem, first, the carrier wasn't was a small carrier without a lot of capacity. They were only carrying 8 Skyhawks, so they couldn't make a big change on the war. Second, it was a very vulnerable ship, and that was evident after the Belgrano was sunk. The Navy realized that they couldn't lose the two bigger ships of the fleet. So they order the carrier to return to harbor. But in the end, I don't think the carrier could have made a big difference on the war, because with only 8 Skyhawks, and because the catapults of the carriers of the carrier were not in the best conditions, so they can't send the planes with a full load of bombs.
Yeah.
Because of the weight, they can only launch them with a couple of bombs. So
let's talk then about after the war. How did and how is the Air Force and the Navy recovering? Because I follow you on social media and I look at some of the posts you make. Tell me about the state of the Argentine Air Force and the Naval Air Wings now.
Yes, I think what some of us say is that the worst enemy for Argentinian military wasn't the British of 1982. In fact, they are the politicians. During the war, Argentina bought a lot of planes. And this is something because in many media I saw that the people say that the Argentinian never recovered from the war, at least on quantity. And the truth is that, yes, Argentina, by the end of 1983, has the same quantity of aircraft that before the war. That's why, because Peru sent to Argentina 10 Mirages as a gift during the war. The idea was to use them on the war.
Yeah.
And Argentina also bought 23 Mirages in Israel during the war. And then also 2 Mirage two-seaters in France. So in the end, there was 35 new Mirages after the war. Arrived all the Superintendents, because Argentina had bought 14 aircraft and only 5 were delivered by the war. And many other aircraft, a Hercules to replace the one lost in the war. There were a lot of new Pucaras built by their factory to replace the planes lost in the war. So in the 80s, immediately after the war, the quantity of aircraft was the same, and training immediately after was at the same level. But after the military government left the government in Argentina in the end of 1983, the new government, because they didn't want any more coup d'etats in Argentina, any more rebellions, so they started to reduce the budget of the military. In the end, in the 80s, this wasn't felt a lot because the Air Force was still very big.
Yeah.
But in the 90s, the Air Force wanted to replace the combat fleet, the Mirages and the Skyhawks, and that wasn't possible. Only 36 new Skyhawks were bought, second-hand anyway. And all this deterioration lasted after 35 years after the war. So in the end, the problem is that Argentina never replaced those aircraft. The Mirages were retired. The Skyhawks, the new Skyhawks, are going to be retired very soon. And this is all the situation of all the armed forces. But the main problem wasn't the war by itself. It's the lack of investment for more than 30 years, and that there's no replacement for anything. Many units were closed. For example, most of the types that were retired from service were never replaced,
yeah,
like the Canberras, Mirages. Many transport aircraft were not replaced. Helicopters, for example, the Chinooks were retired. In part, were replaced by Mi-17s, but they are smaller. They don't have the same capabilities of a Chinook. So a lot of capabilities were lost. Also, the Boeing 707s were retired. The Fokker 27s, all of them were not replaced. That's the main problem, that the armed forces, they learn a lot about the war, that they needed a lot of new capabilities, like air refueling, intelligence, early warning. But the problem is that they never get the money to buy the new equipment.
Yeah. So they were never able to capitalize on that knowledge.
No, that's the main problem. For example, in the 80s, there was a program to modify the 707s with refueling capabilities, and also to modify all the Mirage fleet with the refueling probe. They made a test. I have a picture of a Mirage with a probe installed. But in the end, the program was cancelled because there was no money to install the probe on all the aircraft and no money to modify the 707s. Also, the Navy, for example, developed intelligence-gathering aircraft, and the Air Force, too. The Navy even modified Lockheed Electra for air refueling. But all those aircraft were retired in the end, and all those systems were never adopted on a big scale.
Right. Okay. Very interesting. Santiago, I think that brings us to the end. But before we go, I just want to, as I said, the book that covers the whole of what we've discussed and goes into an awful lot more detail is The Wings of the Malvinas. Excellent book. It's big. It's a proper book. It's a big, heavy book, so it's good to read. Fantastic amount of photography in there. Where can we find out about you and the book online?
Yes, I have a online on social media. I have on all the social media, but the only one I use is Facebook with my page with Santiago Rivas Photo and Press. So I always post information and pictures and all articles I published. I posted some information there and also about my books.
Okay, and I'll put some links to that in the show note, as well as links to where people can buy the book as well. Santiago, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thank you very much for your time. And also thank you for doing this interview in English. I know it's not your first language, but it was very clear, and I learned an awful lot more about the conflict from our discussion. So thank you very much.
No, thank you for the interview. It was very interesting to talk about this also.
Well, we'd love to have you back one time, but this is the final episode in this series. So next time, maybe we can talk about some of your other work. That would be fascinating as well.
Okay, yes, maybe my next book would be about British military aircraft in Latin America, so I think could be interesting for you too.
Yeah, that might be an interesting one. Well, let's get back together on that one then, Santiago. Santiago, thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
We'd like to thank White Hart, Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. We'd also like to say a very special thank you to Santiago and Dave Gledhill for their time and support in producing this particular episode. As the final part of this series of features, we'd also like to thank everyone who's played a part in helping us to research, organise and produce this feature. They've been some of the most challenging yet rewarding episodes we've ever delivered. We do hope you've enjoyed the content and found them insightful. Please do contribute to the debate on the air war by visiting us on Facebook or Twitter, and of course you can always email us as well. So many, many thousands of you have listened to these featured episodes on the 35th anniversary of the Falklands conflict, and we're very, very appreciative of your support. If you feel in the spirit, please, please leave us some feedback. Like our Facebook page, or even better still, score us on our Facebook page. If you don't want to do that, please leave us some feedback on iTunes or your podcast player. This all helps us greatly. Well, that's it. You can find Extended now on all of the popular podcast players and, of course, on iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, so please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. You can find Tim Robinson on Twitter at RAESTimR, and you can find Gareth Stringer on Twitter at Gareth_Stringer. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, and of course I'm always lurking around on our Facebook page or on our Twitter feed. You can also find me at the Aviation and Aerospace Podcast Group on Facebook. That's it, and with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson, and all of the extended team. And remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
This is XTP Media.